This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
Well, hello there, my, it's been a long time.
President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Water Resources Research Act into law in 1964. Abundant, good water is essential to continued economic growth and progress, he said in his official statement on the act. The Congress has found that we have entered into a period in which acute water shortages are hampering our industries, our agriculture, our recreation, and our individual health and happiness. By the year 2000, President Johnson predicted there would not be enough water to meet the needs of many states across the country, including Utah. The act was created to enlist universities around the country to contribute to a nationwide effort to inform good water utility and policy. Less than a year later, the Utah Water Research Lab at Utah State University was born. The facility was placed right in the path of the Logan River, below what's called First Dam at the mouth of Logan Canyon. Pipes run from the reservoir behind the dam directly into the facility so that the river is used for a whole host of experiments and tests before making its way back to its natural bed. The water problems President Johnson addressed in 1964 still haven't been solved. They might never be solved, but for 50 years, the Utah Water Research Lab has been actively working on the problems that plague the state, the West, the entirety of the nation, and even the world. The current director of the lab, Mac McKee, told me that the founders of the Utah Water Research Lab were always trying to understand what the nature of water problems might be in the future. And this is part of the lab's mission, to get ahead of water problems. I met Mac McKee in his office at the Utah Water Research Lab in Logan to talk about what the future looked like in the 1960s and what it looks like now.
Ain't it funny? It's so funny how time can slip right on away. I want to ask you a question. Is it all right?
Can you talk about how water problems are either different or the same as they were 50 years ago? Maybe, I imagine some of them are still around and some of them have changed dramatically.
That's a really interesting question, because the water problems we look at are different and they are very much the same. For example, I'll give you one that's 12,000 years old. We're still working on irrigation. How do we go about efficiently acquiring and delivering water to irrigated fields to grow food? The first instances of that, of which I am aware, have been archaeologically dated to 10,000 BC, when people in Jericho used the water from a spring whose present-day Arabic name is Ain Sultan, which means the king, the king's spring, or the spring of kings. They diverted water from that spring to provide drinking water for the city of Jericho 12,000 years ago, and they also used the water to irrigate crops of barley and primitive wheat varieties and date palms 12,000 years ago. Those people are the forefathers of my profession. We go back 12,000 years, and today we're doing the same kind of thing to address the same sorts of problems. How do we efficiently get water onto the farm? What has changed? We have gotten much more informed about the scientific nature of our problems. For example, when Lake Mead was created, the intent there was very clearly identified. The intent there was to control floods, to provide water storage for downstream uses, and to generate some hydropower. Nobody said a word about endangered fish species, and so no one was looking at that. And it was only many years later that significant environmental dimensions came into our water consciousness. So things haven't changed, and they have changed.
Some of the problems that you mentioned, water problems, are not only old and universal, but they're sort of worldwide. So I know that there's research going on at the Water Lab that has international implications just because of the universal nature of water problems. There's also some sort of hyper-local research that goes on. I mean, the Logan River runs through the facility. So that's a very local use, I think, of what's going on here. So my question is, how do you both apply the research that you're doing locally on an international scale, and what kinds of international problems are you seeking to solve right here in Utah?
The problems that we are working on right here in Utah are very diverse. We're continuing to develop new techniques for acquiring data, and the latest of which is unmanned aerial vehicles. They're flying robots, and they can carry any of a number of different payloads, including some incredibly scientifically punchy payloads involving cameras. And when they come back, we have technology to extract from that imagery all kinds of information about water consumption, about the health of crops. We can see all this from the sky. We can see the spread and quantify the spread of invasive plant species that are choking our wetlands, and not only here in Utah, but all across North America. I have seen the same species in the Senegal River and in places in the Middle East where I've been. This is becoming a global problem, not just here in Utah. Well, we're spearheading a piece of the fight of this. How do you find the stuff when it's out there in the wetlands? If you wait for a satellite to tell you, you might wait 10 years. We can tell you tomorrow.
I know that you have a lot of international students and visitors that come to the Water Lab. What's unique here that people want to come from other parts of the world to study?
International students often live or come from countries and conditions where water problems that have been solved here in the U.S. have not been solved there. And they will often tend to be a lot more interested in solving water problems than American students are. And hence, we do have a very large, at the graduate level, we have a very large contingent of international students. And they want to come here because they know they can get the sort of training and educational experience that will allow them to go home and contribute to the solution of the problems they see at home.
What are some of those problems?
Oh, some of them are just basic water problems, like straightforward issues of water supply and wastewater treatment. Some of them are more sophisticated. For example, we're trying to get some funding to help apply some of our remote sensing technologies that we've developed here, including some satellite stuff, into the hands of Egyptians so that they can do a better job of managing water supply to the entire Nile Delta, where virtually all the food is grown in Egypt. You asked, why do people want to come here? Well, we have facilities right here in the building that are second to none. We have world-class hydraulics modeling and testing facilities. And more important than that, we have world-class faculty who know how to make that stuff work.
I liked when you mentioned when the Water Lab was set up, it had a focus on the future of water and sort of trying to see past the problems of the present time and anticipating what the problems are going to be in the future. What's going to happen? What's in 10, 15, 50 years is going to be the focus, do you think, of Water Lab research?
I don't know if my crystal ball is any clearer than anybody else's crystal ball. So I'll just give you a view into my murky crystal ball here. Our researchers and some of the work that I do, we get to see beyond the borders of Utah, and we get to see what's happening in California and Alaska and in Iraq and in Senegal and so forth. So we see that sort of hazy global perspective as well as what's happening here in Utah. And we're always asking ourselves, okay, what is it that is on our horizon here in Utah? And frankly, in my opinion, the best available science says that the western U.S. and Utah and lots of other places in the world, the best available science says that our hydrologic future over the next 20, 50, 100 years is going to become much more or much less predictable. It will be fraught with much more variability. Do we know what's going to happen? No. What does that tell us we have to do? We have to figure out how institutionally and technologically, how we're going to live with greater uncertainty in the hydrologic cycle. That's a technical problem. We can solve that.
Mac McKee, thanks so much for inviting me to the Water Lab today and for speaking with me.
It's our pleasure. You're welcome anytime.
Wasn't kidding when he said I could come back anytime. I've been back a few times since, and it really is a magical place. They have a room where they can make it rain, and they have huge airplane hangar-sized rooms where they build miniature models of dams. Miniature is kind of a misleading word, though. They're not like train sets. They're big enough that you can walk around on them, Godzilla style. The Water Lab builds these infrastructure models sometimes to solve basic water problems in other countries. One privilege of living in a developed country like the U.S. is that we can safely assume that when we turn on the tap, clean water will come out. The hidden infrastructure of our public services keeps us safe from things like drowning and disease, and rarely do any of us consider all the technology and knowledge that we have that's used to maintain and regulate a safe and clean water supply. When you travel outside the U.S., you start to realize that these privileges we have as Americans are not universal. Recently, some University of Utah scholars and engineers committed to sharing their knowledge of managing water with another university in Pakistan. The source's Ross Chambliss has this story.
A few weeks ago, a small group of dignitaries from Pakistan and academics from the University of Utah gathered for a small ceremony. Together, University President David Pershing and the Vice Chancellor for Pakistan's Mehran University of Engineering and Technology formally signed a Memorandum of Understanding.
Congratulations to both universities. Before concluding, there will be an exchange of souvenirs between President Pershing and Vice Chancellor Aslam Okeri.
For the next 5 years, professors and researchers from the University of Utah have committed to work closely with students and faculty from Pakistan's Mehran University to solve some serious water problems. To understand how these disparate universities came together, we have to go back to 2010.
Officials say 13 million people are now affected. After engulfing the northwest, the waters have spread south.
We lost everything. For God's sake, help us. For God's sake, help us.
The water reached our village. Our children are dying, and others are dying from hunger.
Aid organizations say help is getting through.
Obviously, there are major issues of getting access to the affected population. The Disasters Emergency Committee agencies are reaching about 300,000 people so far. But as the disaster continues to worsen, obviously more people need to be reached.
But for these flood survivors, the growing influence of Pakistan's jihadi groups is the last thing on their minds. All they want is someone, anyone, to lend them a helping hand in these desperate times.
Those were videos and reports from Britain's Sky News and the BBC News from August 2010. They show how devastating the floods, I'm talking on a biblical scale, the event was 5 years ago. That year, USAID, that's the United States Agency for International Development, provided millions of dollars for short-term flood relief efforts. But the agency also began seeking long-term solutions. USAID is basically concerned with helping poor people in other countries with sustainable development, but they're also concerned with American national security. Pakistan is a country with over 190 million people, mostly Muslims, and which borders Afghanistan and Iran. The country has been wrestling with destabilizing Islamic extremism even before these destabilizing natural disasters. So in 2010, USAID worked with authorities to select three of Pakistan's universities to serve as research centers, one for energy, one for food security, and one, Mehran University, was chosen to help Pakistan tackle its water problems. This is Aslam Okeli, the university's vice chancellor.
In 2010 flood, more than 2,000 people have died. And then in the drought situation, people in the desert area, their deaths being occurred because of the not availability of the water. So there's a two extreme condition. Once we have the floods in certain year, we do not have the capacity to really store the water properly so that in the time of the drought, we should use it.
Extreme droughts and extreme floods. The 2010 floods were blamed on heavy monsoon rains and erratic weather that many blamed on climate change. But investigators also attributed the disaster on lax engineering standards and poor infrastructure. The country basically lacks the ability to adjust water levels throughout wet and dry seasons. So when water isn't washing away homes and people, there's not enough of it for people to drink or to grow food. That's why Pakistan is considered among the world's most water-stressed countries.
My first time in Pakistan was when we were at the very end stages of this project being approved.
This is Professor Steve Burian.
I'm an associate professor in civil and environmental engineering. I am also the project director for the U.S.-Pakistan Centers for Advanced Studies in Water from the University of Utah.
Burian says he and another Utah professor, Tariq Banuri, who's originally from Pakistan and who also has interests in sustainable development and water, threw their figurative hat into the ring for the USAID project a few years ago.
You know, he and I got together, we saw this as an opportunity, and we put forth the effort to try to develop it. And so that's where it all started. It was a combination of international interest in water, growing capacity in that area, the opportunity, and then myself and Tariq bringing the team together.
The University of Utah will now lead a consortium of partnering universities that includes Colorado State University, City University of New York, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the Stockholm Environment Institute, and the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO.
You know, I've traveled internationally a fair bit, but I wouldn't say I'm a seasoned world traveler. And so this was a unique experience for me to be able to go to a country that is very different, but in many ways the same, and to explore how from a university to university, so meeting with faculty and students at another university and seeing how they're approaching the same problems from a different perspective was quite interesting.
Brian says meeting with the researchers and faculty from Mehran helped him to realize that people in Pakistan are grappling with many of the same water challenges as we do in the U.S., but he says there are differences.
The difference is in the magnitude and the severity of the issues. You know, you're talking about a flooding affecting 20 million people and losing thousands and thousands of lives. That's something we don't experience in this country. When the Mississippi floods, yeah, we get populations that are affected, and sometimes it affects a city. But we're not talking about 20 million people being directly displaced or affected. When water shortages happen around here, we stop watering lawns. We have times when we can water or wash our cars. But in there, it's you know, people die. And in terms of water quality, we have issues that there's, you know, water quality degradation affecting ecosystems, and it has some implications for public health, and we do have some public health issues that we have to deal with, but there it is, it's children dying every day from waterborne disease. And so I think it's the same type of problems, the same type of solutions can be implemented, but the problems have much, much more severe impacts there.
And so help me understand the program moving forward at this point. It's going to set up a program where students from Pakistan can come here for a semester or two and study intensively water engineering and just water governance topics, and then go back and then try to move forward with expanding their infrastructure over there?
It would take a long time to describe every piece. I'll try to just summarize it very, very briefly. It's a curriculum development program. It's an applied research program. to be able to advance their curriculum. We're helping them with our expertise, and we're partnering with them one-on-one to help them develop courses, to help them develop master's and PhD programs. We're also helping them to become better teachers, and so introducing some of the more advanced techniques and just basic techniques and how to do them effectively. We're very much focused on assessment to help them to continuously improve their programs. Beyond curriculum, there is research, and so we're trying to get them to focus on the applied problems there, but bring in a lot of the expertise that we have and the experience we have with doing high-quality, world-class research and taking advantage of world-class facilities that we're helping them to design and build. And so that's going to be those are the two emphases.
The project will be a $10 million undertaking, with USAID allocating $2 million for the center every year for 5 years. Every year, about 50 students and faculty will come to Utah for research and to work with a team of U of U faculty. What's also noteworthy about this program's design is that 50% of the participating students and faculty from Pakistan will need to be women.
See, in Pakistan, we don't have women leadership in water sector. So I believe that if women represent is not there, so their issues are not highlighted that much.
Zahida Jamali is an assistant professor with Mehran University.
So under this project, what we are trying to do is we are trying to improve technological issues as well, which are directly contributing to social development of family, especially to the women and girls. So that's why I was saying that for any kind of issues, women role is very important, and we have to listen their voices and understand their needs as well, because their needs are different as compared to male and industries.
In the United States too, of course, getting enough women into the engineering workforce remains a problem. In this respect, the two universities plan to share social ideas and programs and get input from resources like the U's Women's Resource Center and the Society of Women Engineers. When the students and faculty from Pakistan arrive at the University of Utah, they'll focus on four key graduate programs: water and sanitation, hydraulics and irrigation, integrated water resources and management, and environmental engineering.
So at the end of the day, when they go back and in the field when they are working, they have the capacity to resolve the issues.
Again, here is the Vice Chancellor, Aslam Okeli.
Because one of the main problem in our country is that we do not have the quality professionals in the water sector. So basically, as a university, our focus is to, number one is to provide quality professionals in the water sector. Number two, to address research projects on a very burning issues like which crop we have to grow, like how water can be conserved, how the water optimization can be done, how the water can be managed.
To put this all into context, the United States has given Pakistan tens of billions of dollars since the 1950s. Today, many of the reservoirs Pakistan now uses were built with USAID funds in the 1960s and 70s. Still, only 9% of Pakistan's water supply is stored in reservoirs. Neighboring India, by comparison, gets about a third of its water supply from reservoirs. Ukeli hopes this time around the American-funded research will lead to ways for Pakistan to sustain itself.
So the two universities will carry out the joint research, and the outcome of the research can be commercialized, which can ultimately be used for the sustainability of the center, because the funding is limited for a certain number of years. Then the center has to run on its own.
Even as recently as 30 years ago, parts of America also struggled with sewage problems and sanitary engineering. The Clean Water Acts in the 1970s may be similar to the progress that is hoped for Pakistan. This, Burian says, could serve as a valuable learning tool for his American students to see the same process rapidly playing out for Pakistan, which occurred relatively slowly here in the U.S.
There is a two-way street, and there's going to be things that we're going to be able to learn. There's going to be things that we're going to refine in what we do from a curriculum and research standpoint as we start to go through this partnership. We're basically trying to help them build capacity, and that effort of our part is going to play back to us and help us to improve what we do. And so it's about improving the water situation, but it's also about improving quality of life, which is inherently tied to water, and that's what we're trying to do.
For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
We're moving from Pakistan to Mexico after a short break. Stay with us.